Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, will cryptocurrency profoundly alter the monetary system? What is the future of cryptocurrencies? What are the pros and cons of them? And what do they mean for economics, for power, and for society? With us are four experts. David Golombia is a professor in the Department of English, Media, Art, and Text program at Virginia Commonwealth University. He's the author of The Cultural Logic of Computation and The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism. His blog is uncomputing.org. Gina Peters also joins us. She is a professor in the Department of Economics at Trinity University and an honorary research fellow at the University College London Center for Blockchain Technologies. She's the author of research papers, Does Bitcoin Reveal New Information About Exchange Rates and Financial Integration? And Cross-Country Distribution of Power and Exposure in the Crypto Market. Lee McKnight is also with us. He's a professor in the School of Information Studies at Syracuse University. He is the co-author of The Gordian Knot, Political Gridlock on the Information Highway, and Cloud to Edgeware, Wireless Grid Applications, Architecture and Security for the Internet of Things, Knowledge Networks, the Internet, and Development. Amin Gunsire is a professor at Cornell University and co-director of the Initiative for Cryptocurrencies and Smart Contracts. He's the co-author of Majority is Not Enough, Bitcoin Mining is Vulnerable, Managing the Network with Merlin, and On the Feasibility, Completely Wireless Data Centers. He developed the precursor to Bitcoin. His blog is hackingdisturbed.com. Amin Gunsire. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. It is wonderful to have you all here with us on a subject that can be quite confusing for many of us, cryptocurrency. As I understand it, somebody named Satoshi Nakamoto invented Bitcoin, but it wasn't really necessarily the very first. I thought perhaps we should start with how did these cryptocurrencies come about and why did they come about? Amin, would you like to start with that?
Sure. The story of cryptocurrencies goes back at least a decade and a half, maybe more, before Satoshi Nakamoto. In the late 80s, David Shalm came up with the idea of e-cash, electronic cash, where somebody could send money to somebody else online with the aid of a centralized entity keeping track of the books. So that's a wonderful thing to do. It essentially allows us to duplicate a system where the bank manages the accounting structure, and the users are free to trade among themselves. And after that, in the early 90s, we had various attempts at building virtual currencies. Some users might have heard of, you know, beans, flus, and peer-to-peer cash of different kinds. But each and every one of them still had that bank idea at its core. Around that time, Rivest and Naur suggested this idea of micromint, which was a system where the creation of the money, as well as the tracking of its whereabouts, of who owned what, was kept track in a fashion without a bank, without a centralized entity. And moving forward in the early 2000s, my group built something called Karma, which was a peer-to-peer currency with a mint that relied on what we call proof of work. That is, we took out the concept of a central bank and actually had completely decentralized way to mint the money, as well as keeping track of who had what. But that's a very well-cited work academically, but the timing wasn't quite right and the marketing wasn't really targeting the right person, the right people. So moving forward a little bit from that, we end up seeing Satoshi Nakamoto come on the scene with a pseudonym, and he proposed a couple of things. One is the same core idea of proof-of-work minting, as well as a new consensus protocol for keeping track of who had what. That creates this notion, this data structure called the blockchain, that keeps track of the global history of transactions across the globe. So, and after Bitcoin was perfectly timed. It came right after the financial crash of the 2007-2008 era, and it offered a bunch of ideas about how the money should be minted according to what schedule that appealed to a certain clientele. And then after that, it took off like wildfire in the sense that people saw this thing as actually having some credibility, as being a reliable system that's really hard to take down, that offers this censorship-free money. And it became a speculative asset. Now we have the current explosion that we have, and people are suddenly finding uses for this technology in all sorts of things, such as issuing securities of different kinds, issuing all sorts of interesting assets, such as crypto kitties, even so little cats that you can breed online. They're kind of like Tamagotchi pets, and everything in between the two. So it's been a very exciting ride.
Gina Peters, what would you add to this?
That was an amazing summary of the history of cryptocurrencies and bitcoins, I must say. I would just echo something Amin pointed out, which is that Bitcoin is not the first of these digital currencies. There have existed previous iterations, and what's different is how much it has exploded in popularity and usage.
David Columbia.
I think Amin sort of hinted at this, but one of the things he didn't say is that in addition to the sort of technical groups that were working on this question, there were some political groups that were working on it around the same time. And they really had a strong political agenda, which had to do with this question of kind of getting rid of the state or getting rid of banks, which they refer to as middlemen or other derogatory terms. And these things happened to come together, as Amin said, right after the financial crash. And there was a sort of emerging together of a political agenda that in my view is far to the right, and this kind of technical capability that came together. You know, one of the interesting things in the discussion even that we've had so far is that we've used the term cryptocurrency to refer to them. And that is certainly what Nakamoto's original paper calls them. But if you look at the uses of what are called cryptocurrencies today, I don't think there's any argument that they are used as currencies. They are used as gambling tokens or speculative tokens of some sort, far more than they are used for what we would normally think of as currency, which is buying and selling of goods and services.
So, David Columbia, if you could elaborate just a little bit about the ideological founding of cryptocurrencies, how can you help us understand that?
Sure. Well, there's a group of technologists who started in the late 1980s and the early 1990s who sometimes call themselves crypto-anarchists and sometimes call themselves cypherpunks. They're similar related groups with many of the same members. And these people took their political and economic philosophy straight out of the farthest right, what we sometimes call libertarian movement in the United States, Murray Rothbard and people like this. And they were convinced, they still are convinced, that government is the ultimate evil in society. And they have written long screeds about how they need to use encryption technology to tear apart government. And one of their goals from the beginning was to develop an alternate kind of money, which they believed would tear apart government. I think, fortunately, they were probably wrong about that. But most of the candidates for whoever Satoshi Nakamoto is, which is likely a group of people, but maybe just one people, but most of the candidates are people who come right out of this crypto-anarchist milieu. And in a recent BBC program that was quite wonderful about Bitcoin, they want to sort of explore the origins, and the person they landed at was a guy named Timothy May, who is a retiree from Intel, who made himself wealthy as an early Intel engineer. And he spoke as though he was pretty closely connected to the group who created Bitcoin, and he is the founder of the crypto-anarchist movement.
So could a group that was really anti-government, really anarchistic, actually have an effect on government with this kind of a currency? Is it possible?
Sure. It's absolutely possible. I mean, it's had an effect, maybe that they've been small effects relative to large governments like the United States or the UK. But it's, you know, depending on, I mean, a lot of governments around the world are regulating various aspects of cryptocurrencies now. And I think that is partly out of fear of what could happen if too many assets pour into them, because they are so far out of the ordinary systems of financial instrument regulation. I think Dr. Peters has also written some very interesting papers that talk about how smaller countries with maybe less extensive ability to control their currency could be impacted by Bitcoin trading across borders and exchanging for the local currencies.
Well, we're going to go to that then next, but let's first get Lee McKnight's thoughts. What would you add to this, Lee McKnight?
Well, first I'll add a historical footnote that I was part of the Internet Mercantile Protocol working group that was crashed by those cypherpunks that were referenced earlier, who did not want, and this is working with larger companies. I'd authored a book called Internet Economics. This is 20 years ago, and they did not want something like Bitcoin to be created within the normal realm of everyday business. So they literally like spammed the list nonstop for years and just sort of shut it down. With they were calling themselves anarcho-syndicalists at that time, but it was definitely the cypherpunk community. Now, jumping up forward, though, here's something the listeners need to keep in mind, that as was noted, you know, while the cryptocurrencies, quote unquote, are the quote unquote is around the word currency, because that's what they want to be, that's what they may grow up to be, but that's not really what they are now. They're certainly not defined as that by the IRS, the Securities and Exchange Commission, or by New York State Financial Services, in which in all cases they're defined as an asset, so a new type of a digital asset that's been created through the technologies that were, you know, previously discussed. Now, of course, it can be used as a speculative instrument for exchange. However, compared to Visa, PayPal, MasterCard, Venmo, everything else that's used for value exchange these days, Bitcoin is way worse, way slower, has a much lower transaction volume that it can handle. Of course, it might improve in future. That's one. Next thing I'd add is for under current law, if you are transferring over $10,000 through Bitcoin, and you're not reporting it to the government in the United States, you're violating financial regulations, you're money laundering. So within the U.S., whatever people say about it being anonymous, you still must comply with the existing law.
I'd like to add, this is Emin Sira from Cornell here, I'd like to add just a few things to this, just so that the listeners can sort of disentangle the various different concepts that are at play here. Underlying any cryptocurrency, or at least these cryptocurrencies that people are so excited about, is a fundamental technology called the blockchain. And that I am very, very bullish about. That core technology holds the promise to revolutionize the way many different industries keep track of information in their back offices. That is, whereas normally I would have a database belonging to my business, and you might have a database belonging to your business, and then suddenly we have to have these machines communicate and agree upon, et cetera, and keep their records in sync, which is a non-trivial problem. We could have a common shared database without a custodian that we trust and pay. So that is interesting from a business perspective. A second thing that's interesting, another concept that should come up in any discussion like this, is another technical idea called smart contracts, which has absolutely no bearing to any smartness at all, and really not anything to things that we know as contracts in law. But what they are really are programs that control the flow of digital money. So we can have programs that deterministically behave according to some set schedule without human meddling or intervention. And I am very bullish on that particular technology as well, because it holds the ability for us to automate without any trust those easy parts of a business. So, for example, simple examples for smart contracts might be that we want to play chess and we want to put some money into a game, and we don't want to actually create a trusted entity for managing who won the game. And we can do this with that. Or you want to have a manager for a rock band to divide the money according to a set schedule. You can do that without the actual manager. And of course, there are many other interesting examples, much more interesting ones in the case of peer-to-peer insurance and so forth. And there, I'm actually so bullish as to say that it's going to be an extinction-level event for many traditional companies. That is, we'll see the rise of interesting businesses that take advantage of these technologies. But when it comes to cryptocurrencies, I think everything that has been said so far is right on. They hold a very funny position legally. In some consideration, like CFTC considers them to be currencies. They're regulated as currencies. If you spend too much or if you send too much, then you're subject to all sorts of reporting laws. They're also taxed as assets, which complicates the tax filing incredibly, and they have a bunch of performance problems that, at least at the moment, they suffer from. Although there is technology that various different groups are working on, including mine, for improving their scale, for improving their latencies.
You mentioned that you thought some things would go extinct, some types of businesses, middlemen, perhaps. Which ones do you see disappearing?
So in particular, any middleman who does not provide an ostensible value add is subject to elimination. Now, It's kind of interesting to really kind of be, I have to be nuanced here, and it's difficult. So among the circles that have adopted this technology, there's great excitement about decentralizing all things. They are really, really thrilled. They just love to look at anything. With Facebook, let's decentralize Facebook. Wouldn't it be great if we had Facebook with nobody in charge? Wouldn't it be great if we had Google without anybody in charge and so forth? Those people, like those services that they target, they seem like middlemen. Let's take Google. What does it really do? They look at Google and they suddenly see, they see a search engine, let's say. That's just one aspect of Google's business. And it seems like you could decentralize that. But what they don't see is the value add that Google brings by doing all the other things to ensure that their search index is clean of spam, of detecting the bad actors. And it's very difficult to programmatize that. It's very difficult to build that into a blockchain. So there's a lot of hype, a lot of excitement around technologically infeasible ideas. There's a lot of hype around getting rid of middlemen without understanding the actual value they bring to the equation. But there are many other businesses and core aspects of certain businesses that could be put on a blockchain. So in particular, middlemen who bring little to the table is one. And the other one, of course, is middlemen that don't generate trust. They are subject to an existential threat from these new technologies. For example, the country of Georgia placed their land records on a blockchain. And the idea there is, that the people don't have enough trust in the way the records are kept. And blockchains give you that ability to audit the record of transactions. So there is reason to be optimistic about the technology, while there are many, many, many reasons to be skeptical of a lot of claims, as well as many of the security-type offerings that we have seen in the space.
Lee McKnight, go ahead.
Agreeing with what was just noted, that there's many uses of blockchain, many of which have nothing to do with a cryptocurrency per se. So I'll just give one example now of IBM and Maersk, the big shipping company, looking to automate and eliminate a lot of those middlemen and the sort of errors and paperwork between shipping and logistics going from a factory someplace to the port, to the ship, to it offloading in another port, getting out through the customs handlers and everything else. IBM in particular has been focusing on all of these non-cryptocurrency related uses of blockchain and has a number of at least a dozen commercially usable systems now already deployed. And I'm sure that number of commercial uses of blockchain without on supply chain automation and efficiency, middleman elimination will grow exponentially over the coming years.
I just want to make sure that those of us who are very new to this conversation understand how blockchain works. Lee McKnight, do you want to kind of walk us through that a little bit? And then Gina Peters, I'll have you jump in.
We're talking about starting with with cryptography. So we're starting with very complex math to provide mathematical proof that a transaction has occurred. And so that's going back to what this whole history over the 20 years that we described was. And then having that not proven just or accepted by one peer or one system, but by distributed across all the nodes within the network. So that in the Bitcoin transaction, essentially, if one hacker was going to try to break that transaction, it's basically impossible because those same records exist on many, many other computers. And there's this automated mathematical process for which any new transaction, any new block being added to the record, it has to be agreed by other peer systems that transaction is valid and not somebody trying to hack the system and sort of essentially steal assets through that. For the listeners, the good news is we know this works or the Bitcoin markets and the other cryptocurrency markets couldn't exist. So you don't have to understand the math and recognize that this is really a significant advance. Cryptography existed before, but being able to use it and combine it with either proof of work that was described earlier, and that's on which Bitcoin is based, or systems like Hyperledger Fabric that's based around proof of stake, in which pre-identified groups are recognized as having a role in confirming transactions or record changes in the record to the block and adding them to the chain. So we have the block and then the chain creation together. Hence, we get the phrase blockchain, or another phrase we'll introduce. I don't think we've said this yet, a distributed ledger technology, or we have said distributed databases. So these are all sort of synonyms or related to the core concept of having this very solid, mathematically, almost basically unbreakable proof of changes to the record, enabling the Bitcoin market to exist.
Gina Peters.
There's a lot of excitement about getting rid of intermediaries whose sole purpose it is to record, maintain, adjust, or verify data using the blockchain. And I'm really glad that he pointed out very specifically that a lot of this is overexcitement, perhaps, because there is an assumption that all intermediaries or all middlemen do nothing at all. And I don't think that's necessarily the case. I think Google is a great example to use for that. An interesting thing is potentially what happens with monopolies, if monopolies form, if some of these intermediaries currently are monopolies, how would they fight back? Because we do like the solutions we know. So even if a blockchain could be a better solution, it's possible that intermediaries that are monopolies that just represent every solution that everybody knows could still win out. So I think it'll be a fascinating space to see what happens as blockchains expand beyond cryptocurrencies.
So how can novices like me, and I'm sure some of our listeners, understand these issues such as Bitcoin mining and proof of work? I mean, what in the rest of the world can we compare them to?
Bitcoin is an example of a cryptocurrency. And you can think of mining as being the accountants within the Bitcoin system to make sure that everybody has the Bitcoins they say they have. And proof of work is the thing that makes sure that the miners aren't lying. That's a extreme simplification. And proof of work is really on the technical side of the blockchain verification system. Sorry, how does it work?
How does it work?
I feel like I want to give this a question to Amin, given that he kind of invented it.
Amin, it's yours.
So in Bitcoin circles, there's this running joke that it's impossible to explain how Bitcoin works in less than 20 minutes. And at the end, nobody will be any wiser, except they'll have confused metaphors. So I'm afraid I won't be able to do a great job, but I'll give you my very short pitch. It works by a cooperative process where individuals who operate these mining nodes that were just described as accountants keep track of who gave whom else how much money. And they add what we call blocks, that is, it's equivalent to pages in a ledger. They add these blocks to this global data structure called a blockchain that records since the beginning of Bitcoin time, that is, since 2009, every single transaction that took place, including the minting process. So these miners get compensated for their work by some newly minted tokens. Every time they add a block, which happens every 10 minutes, they make about 12 bitcoins, which at the current rate is about $70,000. So every 10 minutes, there's an auction going to the miner that can complete this proof of work. And when they do, they get to add a ledger page to everyone's ledger that says so many people gave so much money to these other people. And so this advances what we know about who has how much money, and life goes on from there. That's the shortest explanation I can give in radio format. I hope it's somewhat clear.
Amin, can I sort of jump in?
Sure, please.
And ask what you think about this one-sentence summary for the Bitcoin blockchain. Like, get your approval on it. I've always told people just to envision it as a giant Excel spreadsheet in the sky that everyone can write on and read.
Yeah, that's right. That's a very simplified model, and it's a very good one. The essential thing, of course, is if we had an Excel spreadsheet in the sky, I would put a line item there that says, I gave you some money, I would get some goods from you, then I would delete that.
And that exactly is the counterfeiting problem that we see with traditional digital currencies or even traditional physical currencies. And the way you prevent that counterfeiting is through the hashing and the proof of work and all that stuff.
Exactly. So what you have at the end of the day is an immutable ledger, a ledger that essentially is very, very, very difficult and expensive to rewrite. So what that really means is that Bitcoins are bearer assets. If I give you some Bitcoin, there's no take-backsies. And that's both good for certain use cases and terrible for certain others. It's terrible for consumers. They're not used to, for example, losing their phone and having their accounts emptied without recourse. And that happens daily. Or having a malware infection and having their accounts emptied again without recourse. So it's a true digital bearer asset. Whoever has the private key controls the funds, and there is no going back.
So maybe that's a good time to talk about the pros and cons of cryptocurrencies. Lee McKnight and David Golombia, let's bring you back in. Lee McKnight, how would you break down the pros and the cons of these cryptocurrencies?
A quick pro, as is noted, is you have this perfect immutable record. And now we get to the con. So when you have that perfect record and then you're storing it off the chain in a digital wallet, it would be called, or it's being traded through a cryptocurrency exchange, neither the wallet nor the cryptocurrency exchange has this perfectly mathematically unbreakable system in place. It's just a typical IT system, no more secure necessarily than Atlanta's government. So we have, for example, the heist of $500 million in January from an exchange, a coin check in Japan, where of a coin called NEM or NEM, I'm not sure which way we pronounce it. So you have this perfect record. They still have the record of all those coins, $500 million. So they're saying, oh, we still have the record. We know which coins were taken, but they have no mechanism to retrieve them, as just was noted. So that would be a major con. If you have this perfect record, but if you're not doing anything more than traditionally sloppy IT around it, you're leaving yourself quite vulnerable because you're sort of aggregating and concentrating assets, just like for bank robbers. Where do bank robbers go? They go to the bank because that's where the money is. Cryptocurrency exchanges are the same deal. They're no more difficult to hack than anything else, and the hackers know that, and they steal a lot. There's been many, Mt. Gox in Japan several years earlier, another famous heist in Hong Kong, and then in Seoul, the North Koreans were hacking them. To get in this market, if you believe you have perfect security because of the blockchain, you're wrong, because you're now storing it in a digital wallet or it's being traded through a cryptocurrency exchange that's no better than the average. Losing your money without the recourse to the government or anything else is a major con.
David Columbia.
I just have something brief. I'm mostly interested in this sort of politics behind it rather than some of the technical aspects, but I agree with what most people have said. There's an example here that we can use that would help. So one of the middlemen who offers currency-like services are credit cards, right? Visa and MasterCard. And if you read like Reddit about Bitcoin, right, the idea that what one of the services that Visa and MasterCard provide is chargebacks. If there's been a problem with an error transaction or something has been stolen, whatever, Visa, the middleman, can reverse that transaction, right? And at least the way the blockchain works currently, you can't do that. So that's a value add. Most consumers, as Eamon said, probably appreciate that, right? And there's a lot of protections in using credit cards. We could debate about whether they charge the right amount for that or whatever, but it's a service that most people like and would prefer to have. And what interests me in particular is that ideology that's being sold, right? That there's something inherently wrong with this sort of middleman position. That does worry me. And that to me is a downside, right? In the sense that we've all talked about the hype around Bitcoin, blockchain, is the most extreme hype around any digital technology that I'm aware of. I think some of the uses that people have described so far here are quite reasonable. They might even have some, you know, impact on certain industries, as Eamon was saying. That still seems like very mild compared to what the Bitcoin fanatics think is going to happen because of Bitcoin, and that the selling of this really kind of scary worldview is really, to me, is a big downside of the technology. In certain ways, as Lee said, right, it kind of gets in the way of using the technology for what it might reasonably actually be useful for.
Up next, the illicit uses of cryptocurrencies. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. What is the future of cryptocurrencies? And what do they mean for economics, for power, and for society? With us are four experts, David Golombia, Gina Peters, Lee McKnight, and Amin Gunn-Searer. David Golombia, I was thinking about, because I am a political scientist, and so I'm interested in things from a political science point of view. And of course, the central tenet in all of political study is power. And one of the arguments about cryptocurrencies is that it helps the unbanked be banked. You know, somebody in Kenya can have that money available and be able to build a business as some person in United States who is in a middle class situation. Is there a power differential in the cryptocurrency that is mirroring a current power structure? Or is it, like the idealists say, more egalitarian?
I don't want to rule out that there might be some cases where what you've described would be real. But in my experience and from what I've been able to read, most of the people who claim to be using Bitcoin in particular as a way to equalize power, on the one hand, use that kind of rhetoric. But on the other hand, they talk with real hate about all of the existing structures that we have whose purpose is to equalize power, like regulations on, just a very good example, right, is regulations on trading markets that prevent people from using trading markets to scam other people. I mean, securities trading. In the case of Bitcoin, the markets are full of all these kinds of scams that have been made illegal for a long time in the U.S. by the SEC. And I don't see that as something that's helping to distribute power to, you know, weaker or poorer people. I see it as providing means for very wealthy people or people who may want to become wealthy to, you know, scam from other people. And we keep seeing these concentrations of power developing that are outside, or at least theoretically outside, the realm of the state to contain. And I am quite skeptical of people who use that rhetoric of equalizing power. The politics they express when they're talking otherwise is not about what I would describe as equality, is about individual freedom above all else. I mean, just to use the Kenya example that you've given, there are some wonderful banking and mobile phone and currency transfer applications out there that provide very low-cost services across many parts of the developing world. And when people have really dug in and compared them to what Bitcoin and blockchain are offering, which among other things is a very volatile currency, so you're a token, right? It's very risky to put any of your assets to it. It sure seems like there are not traditional, but more ordinary digital services that do that work quite a bit better than Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies do at this point.
So I'd like to expand a little bit on what David said, especially on the sort of irresponsible marketing of certain cryptocurrencies. So for sure, on the unbanked side, there are potential uses and applications of Bitcoin for the unbanked in the third world. But what we see much more often is the unbanked in the first world. And who are the unbanked in the first world? They're typically people who are doing things that are not allowed legally. And so there is some undertone of a hint and a wink and a nudge when people talk about the unbanked, of one kind versus the other. And the actual deployment of these kinds of technologies in essentially the third world is hampered by a bunch of other problems that they have. Like if, for example, Venezuela were to switch to Bitcoin, every Venezuelan would get to make a transaction every 36 days. So the scale is just not there to be able to handle that kind of a transition. So the vision is one thing. The reality is quite another. Another irresponsible marketing act is the store of value business that deserves, I think, a little bit of discussion. Bitcoin is sold as a store of value using an ancient form of sort of monetary value idea, saying that because there are only a finite number of Bitcoin, its value can only go up. Well, this argument was made most strongly in December, and since December, Bitcoin went from $19,000 per coin down to $6,500 per coin. So that's some store of value right there. It's completely irresponsible to pitch this coin whose supply is completely algorithmic. So it's fixed. There's nothing on earth that can change how it's supplied. So therefore, its price is going to fluctuate with demand. So it can go up or it can go down. It's not a store of value by any sort of traditional interpretation of that phrase. So we see that happening all the time. And I wanted to caution the readers, but listeners, against any such claims. They need to take them. They need to be very skeptical because there's a lot of hype and a lot of incorrect claims floating around in the space.
Gina Peters.
Just to come back to your original question about the pros and cons, just briefly, I think it's difficult to come up with a solid list of pros and cons that apply for all cryptocurrencies, because the interest in cryptocurrencies will actually change the blockchain rules, and those changes change the way the cryptocurrency works. So, for example, for Bitcoin, and this has been mentioned in passing, it takes 10 minutes for a transaction to go through. Some of these newer cryptocurrencies have faster times, or they can hold more data in them. So in Bitcoin, one of the problems is speed. That may not be the same amount of problems for other cryptocurrencies. So it's hard to come up with a solid list of pros and cons for both of them, but I think some really good ones have been raised. Sort of two points I want to raise, especially the unbanked question. We have mobile banking. Why are the unbanked not doing mobile banking? So when people talk about the unbanked and blockchain will bank the unbanked, there's this question of, well, why are the unbanked on mobile banking yet? That's sort of a step one question. Because if they can't do mobile banking, why should we assume that blockchain is somehow going to solve that? If the issue is they don't have internet where they are, but whether the banking is being done on blockchain or whether the banking is being done by a traditional bank, they're not going to be banked. It's as simple as that. But you need to have government or something putting that infrastructure into place. The other way in which I've heard banking, the unbanked, being used is, for example, with entrepreneurship or with money lending or sort of borrowing or lending of funds in a global network. So somebody in Kenya could get access to loans from somebody from the US. So a Kiva style on steroids using blockchain. So that's a different kind of banking the unbanked rhetoric that happens there.
And is that accurate? Does that work?
So right now, there is a lot of cross-currency flows within the cryptocurrency space, though how much of that is just speculative or taking advantage of the various flows, who knows? I don't have the data set for that yet. The entrepreneurship angle, so if you want to think of ICOs, initial coin offerings, which is starting up these new businesses based on blockchain technology, some of these new businesses will issue coins to help fund them to get off the ground. So most of those tend to be concentrated. The last I saw, about 50% of those ICOs were occurring from companies based in the US. About a quarter from those were in Europe, another, you know, so 22% Europe, and then a similar fraction, or 20% Europe, 20% Asia, and then the rest was Middle East and Africa. So you still have your very traditional clustering of financial centers there. So it's not obvious to me that it's working in that sense yet.
Lee McKnight, you had something in your writing about the commodifying of trust. And I'd like to understand this idea a bit, how it works and if there are vulnerabilities there.
Well, first, I'll just want to bring back in on the con and pro-con side. Some other studies have been suggesting that up to 80% of the existing cryptocurrencies are essentially fraudulent. So they're scams started by people to take advantage of. I think the SEC just brought charges against several people. Aside from the large number of essentially fraudulent efforts to take money from people, the groups weren't even serious about creating a real cryptocurrency. They were just serious about taking people's money. Even within the valid cryptocurrencies, such as Bitcoin, studies by economists have shown that just a few traders or few people holding large positions in the cryptocurrencies, especially in these early days, were able to sort of essentially manipulate the price up. Usually up was for the direction they wanted to move. So a negative in the cryptocurrency markets is that currently, again, with that slow transaction processing speed for Bitcoin, well, Bitcoin's one of the most heavily traded, but the other ones down the charts are, so we should caution the listeners to be very wary about, like, which, if you're going to speculate or invest in whichever way you think about it in any cryptocurrency, to avoid a lot of the ones. There's 50, if you go to allmarketcap.com, there's 1,500 cryptocurrencies, and most of them, according to the studies, would be fraudulent, and only the most heavily traded ones could you trust are not being manipulated by insiders. So that's the con. Now we'll go back to the concept of trust and commodifying it. So what's possible now with the process of essentially creating and managing blocks between distributed entities? So it could be within a cryptocurrency space or in other markets in which a not the proof of work, but the proof of stake basis is being utilize, in which before the start of the creation of the block, it's that these three companies, these four government agencies, and XYZ other groups, whether it's the Georgia land trading or other examples like that. Now we're establishing a mechanism, a technical mechanism, a commodity, which is the blockchain itself, which enables trust to be maintained and established and amongst these distributed entities on an ongoing basis. So there might still be intermediaries there in on the chain as part of this community that are having some role to play. So it's not taking out the government, as others have warned against. It's like establishing a stronger linkage to maintain or create trust on an ongoing basis between multiple entities without requiring quite the same level of audit and duplicate record keeping of, you know, five more copies going. Everybody gets tired of having to make the same copy of a document, you know, 10 times of giving it to different people. Having, well, just give the example to like commodifying trust. If you go into a hospital, you say your name, you say your history, then you go to the next stop and you say it again and you do it again. So in a blockchain system, that record, once it's entered, that the person at the front desk believed you on what your name was and what your medical conditions were, that would continue and carry on through it. So it's not being the effort, the repeat effort of maintaining trust through a system would not require you or anybody else to repeat the same information or to reestablish your identity. You know, you just established your identity at the front desk. Now you need to do it, you know, at the nursing station. Why? That makes no sense at all. So trust itself can be commoditized somewhat. Now, we're not taking out all the intermediaries, but we're sort of building them into a system that makes that establishment of trust possible.
So actually, can I push back on that? This is Gina.
Gina Peters.
Sure. I think actually the healthcare records example is for me one of the most fascinating ones in this particular space when you think about blockchain application, because there has been a big push within the United States to get digital healthcare records sort of across the United States and standardized. And what's fascinating is that they are not. So the, one of the reasons you have to keep giving your information is because of these healthcare records aren't shared across your different providers. And why aren't they shared? It's because your providers are using different systems. And why are they using different systems? Because each of these systems become monopolies and they want to maintain that monopoly. So even though in the aggregate, everyone is worse off, these monopolies have a big incentive to maintain their existence. So that's one of these examples of intermediaries where I'm not convinced.
I totally agree with all you said, and that's a point that went towards a disruptive potential of this technology, where it would be a threat potentially to some of those existing intermediaries, because in a way, in this world, they really wouldn't be necessary, and they would be, if somebody came along with a more trusted system in which their role is sort of essentially taken out, that is a threat. So this is not going to, I absolutely agree that they will resist. It's not guaranteed to succeed. However, in whether it's a government agency or for a hospital or some key actors, they may say, you know what, we can do better than this now thanks to a blockchain. And I know there's many different groups within the pharmaceutical medical community. That's one of the most active areas for application of blockchain. Have we seen giant savings yet? Actually, I'll just give one example. So there's a new EU regulation on maintaining the records that pharmaceuticals have been shipped and haven't been stored above a certain temperature in which they could go bad. So this is a new EU-wide regulation. So there's a company that's basically built a system with sensors and a blockchain technology to essentially monitor so that they can have a verified true record that the pharmaceuticals were at never above that temperature. Okay, so there's obviously other systems that exist already that were doing something like this before, but they didn't have the same level of trust. And these new innovations, I do expect, would roll out. Once Europe has this, how are we going to manage to be in the U.S. without something similar? I believe we will make progress. I agree there will be much resistance to areas where progress is possible.
I'd like to turn to something that Amin started to talk about, which is there was a bit of overhype in terms of value and that sort of a thing. And I bring this up partly because, you know, in the New York Times, Paul Krugman had written, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks ago about a possible Bitcoin bubble. And it sounds a little bit like the bubble has slightly burst. Not completely, but what are the potentials for this kind of bubble behavior and what might the consequences of that be, Amin?
That's an interesting question. But we are seeing a couple of things. And from a technologist's point of view, I can tell you what's going on. So we are seeing a huge number of projects start out and hit the crowds for money. So they're bypassing the traditional venture capital now, of course, this comes with a lot of risk, right? So your mom and pop operators who invest in these schemes that are typically run by a couple of students with a master's degree or two among them, you know, the chances that they will see their money back are pretty small, as it is with any venture. But it's interesting. It's interesting that this is happening. In one way, I suspect that this is because there's a huge shortage of good places to park your money. And so cryptocurrencies start to look attractive. They have, if nothing else, they have fluctuations. And so they go up and down at least. And if maybe if you pick the right instrument, you might see these huge gains that we have seen historically. On the other hand, we see venture capitalists actually love ICOs, these initial coin offerings, where people offer tokens to raise money for a company, because it allows a way for the venture capital to get out. They can exit without an IPO. In the old days, you know, you'd have to get a seed stage funding for 200K. You'd prove yourself a little bit. You'd get a few million. Then you'd get, you know, tens of millions and so forth. And you'd ultimately IPO. And that would take multiple years, a good part of a decade, perhaps. Now people are coming in, and with just a white paper, they're raising, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's craziness in the other direction. And as a society, we have to develop an immune system that sort of can counteract all of this and find the right medium. I think neither extreme is good. I think we saw from the venture capital world, they were investing in things like Juicero. And are they doing their due diligence that you expect? There is that slow process. But are they able to weed out the chaff from the wheat? I don't know. I just read about Theranos, and you know, it's it looks like nobody ever really reads the actual statements from the companies with any critical eye in the venture capital world. So we have an interesting situation here, and the pendulum is swinging from one side to the other, and it's not unhealthy in my opinion. Yes, it's extreme at times, but there has to be a medium here that we can find.
The last couple of things I wanted to get to deals with government regulation, or as I understand, China is actually trying to ban Bitcoin. And I wanted to get into that a little bit, what that might mean, and also the uses of cryptocurrency for things that you would not be able to transact on, whether they are terrorism activities or money laundering or any of those types of things. And maybe that's a possibility for why governments are starting to crack down a little bit. So let's look at the regulatory aspect of it.
This is Lee. So I sort of looked at that relatively closely. So why don't we start with talking about the New York State Department of Financial Services BIT license, which is one of their, you know, basically early reviews from, I think, 2015, establishing a legal framework for those trading in cryptocurrencies. And that established a baseline by which if you were going to set yourself up as a cryptocurrency exchange, you essentially you were regulated, was still lightly regulated, but was regulated as if you were trading in other financial services instruments. So that met a lot of objection, and people said, well, let's move our trading operation somewhere else. So there's only been a few companies that have gone through the New York State licensing procedures. In the meantime, as was noted before, there were recent Senate hearings with the Securities and Exchange Commission and the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. And perhaps as a sign of the times, they didn't exactly have the same position. The SEC came out quite clearly stating that ICOs, these initial coin offerings, were the equivalent of an initial stock offering. And all those companies that did those essentially violated the Securities and Exchange Commission regulations. Now, the good news for your listeners are that if you bought any of those coins out of an ICO, you're not personally liable. However, the companies that put on the ICO, they could be fined, or maybe even retroactively, even if they did this previously, when there wasn't this clear SEC statement. So that's because of the SEC, and then the Commodities Futures Trading Commission, was noted, was more favorable towards, they set up the trading on, I think, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange just recently. So there, it's been more supportive, and the cryptocurrency community has been much happier about the CFTC than other regulators. Going outside of the U.S. to Japan, was very lightly regulating cryptocurrencies until that $500 million loss I mentioned earlier in the show. And now the Japanese financial markets regulators have sort of put in similar regulation to what New York State already had, which is if you're a cryptocurrency exchange, you have to, you know, a proper exchange, meaning you have certain baseline security mechanisms and registration procedures like anybody else. And they find that they're quite a high exchange, and they had to sort of reimburse their investors. South Korea, at the national government level, they were planning to shut down cryptocurrency exchanges after there were a couple of those bankruptcies I mentioned last year following allegedly North Korean hacks. Now, however, just in the most recent news, the city of Seoul has come out talking about using the blockchain technology for its own purposes. And now jumping to China real quickly, at the national government level, they announced that they prohibited the banks in China from taking in or using cryptocurrencies or allowing their customers to buy cryptocurrencies from a bank. However, the miners that we talked about previously are in China. Allegedly, the Chinese government has said they were going to come after them too, but I haven't heard anything to say they've actually been shut down. So I guess last two more countries, Venezuela has come out and announced a plan to establish the Petro, which would be a national cryptocurrency. They've launched that. They said they took in about $750 million, but it was explicitly for the purpose of evading U.S. sanctions. Putin in Russia has announced similar plans, but I don't think that one's launched yet. So we're seeing a wide range of government actions to sort of regulate and sometimes to promote the use of cryptocurrencies.
Fascinating. We're just about out of time, so I thought we would do sort of final comments. Gina, I hear you. So why don't we start with you, Gina Peters?
I just wanted to follow up with some of the points made. So I think a lot of people associate cryptos with illegal activity, in part because the first time most people heard about cryptos was in connection to Silk Road, which was this marketplace where you could buy and sell illegal goods or activities, and the payment system that was used there was most frequently Bitcoin. Since then, it's broadened its market appeal. You do still see very different behavior of prices across different exchanges based upon how legally compliant they are. And you see different prices in different exchanges across different countries, also potentially depending upon regulatory environments, which is just a fascinating development from an economist's perspective. I think the question you run into when you ask about criminal activity or regulating cryptos is this small versus big criminal activity question. So on one hand, an individual on Silk Road buying drugs is different from a country like Venezuela intentionally releasing a crypto just so they can evade capital sanctions. So what do you mean by regulation? It depends on what kind of criminal deed you are referring to. And then you run into further problems. So for example, suppose you're in a country where you are very concerned about the government or the government's stability, or you're afraid the government is going to be retaliating against you and your family in some way, right? If you then upload your wealth into Bitcoin so that you can be, if you have to run, you can still access your wealth without having to depend upon the banking system to release the money to you, or without physically carrying cash across borders with you, you might be breaking the rules of your own country, but is there a humanitarian argument to be made for allowing you to do that? So the regulatory discussion is actually more subtle than I think most people realize, because there's the individual criminal activity and then there's the country level, in a sense, criminal activity.
Final thoughts, Emin?
So I'm quite excited about what the technology offers here. There's going to be a lot of changes in industry. It's high time that we look at the back ends of our systems that we have built. It's high time to open up some of the financial services that are currently in the hands of incumbents or oligopoly. On the other hand, there are a lot of scams out there. So I would caution everybody to be very careful and to not view these things as investments necessarily unless they've done extreme due diligence.
David Columbia.
This has been a wonderful conversation, and I mostly just agree with what everybody else has said. I guess one thing that hasn't come up exactly, although Iman mentioned it in passing, another meaning of the word regulation, which you hear in cryptocurrency circles, is the government regulating the money supply. Some of the original point of these cryptocurrencies was to replace central banks, and central banks arguably regulate the money supply, although how they do that is pretty complicated and nuanced. And the belief in some of the most hardcore cryptocurrency world is that you regulate the value of money by regulating the money supply in a very direct and sort of linear way, so that, as Emin said, you know, there's a cap of 21 million theoretically on Bitcoin, and that is supposed to guarantee its value. And I think that that is a very bad way of thinking about economics and finance. And
this is the economist laughing.
Right? I mean, if you look at the gold standard, which is what they are sort of comparing this to, I mean, gold standard.
Do not get me started.
Right? I mean, they fluctuate all over the place. They are themselves regulations of it. You know, however you decide to tie your currency to gold and to its value is very complicated. And, you know, the sort of spreading of this kind of thinking, as I've said before, we've expressed a lot of caution, which is great. It's worth people sort of investigating at least a little bit some of what it is we've been warning about. If you really want to understand this world, there is some really not very nuanced or well-informed thinking out there about some of these issues, and I think there's reason to worry about a lot of this.
This is Ali. I'm calling in from Atlanta, where the city government has been shut down partially for the last 10 days because of a malware in their systems. The hackers have been demanding $51,000 in Bitcoin. Now, obviously, they could have asked for U.S. dollars or some other currency, but yes, it's taking advantage of the anonymity of the system to cripple the city. So this kind of malware hacks, I'm afraid, are becoming more common. And the currency preferred by the hackers is Bitcoin because of its anonymity features. Now, it seems kind of crazy that the city gets held hostage for that low a number. If you're a good thief, you would charge Atlanta more than somebody else, but they send out spam, and whichever person was successfully spearfished by this, it's the same system, whether it's Atlanta or some other community. Now, going beyond that, I totally agree with what's said in saying we have to sort of move beyond this kind of hype and hysteria phase around cryptocurrencies to understanding more broadly in the community. I appreciate you taking the time with this radio program, the Scholar Circle, to help your listeners. Myself, I'm teaching what I believe is a first course called Blockchain Management at Syracuse University now for the second offering of the course. And that tells you, in a way, how new this all is, that there's only, as far as I know, there's other courses on crypto and related issues. But understanding more broadly the management of blockchain systems is a very, very new subject, which I'm sure will grow over time.
Well, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle and for sharing your research and your thoughts with us. It's been a great pleasure hosting you.
Thank you.
It's been great to be here.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
David Golombia is a professor in the Department of English, Media, Art, and Text program at Virginia Commonwealth University. He's the author of The Cultural Logic of Computation and The Politics of Bitcoin, Software as Right-Wing Extremism. His blog is uncomputing.org. Gina Peters is a professor in the Department of Economics at Trinity University and an honorary research fellow at the University College London Center for Blockchain Technologies. She's the author of research papers, Does Bitcoin Reveal New Information About Exchange Rates and Financial Integration? And The Potential Impact of Decentralized Virtual Currency on Monetary Policy. Lee McKnight is a professor in the School of Information Studies at Syracuse University. He is the co-author of The Gordian Knot, Political Gridlock on the Information Highway. He's also co-editor of Creative Destruction, Business Survival Strategies in the Global Internet Economy. Amin Gunsayer is a professor at Cornell University and co-director of the Initiative for Cryptocurrencies and Smart Contracts. He's the co-author of Majority is Not Enough, Bitcoin Mining is Vulnerable. He developed the precursor to Bitcoin. His blog is hackingdisturbed.com. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.